low win rates, excessive discounting, challenging negotiations. Welcome to the Sales Readiness Podcast, a podcast brought to you by the Sales Readiness Group. We're an industry-leading sales training company that helps businesses develop highly effective sales organizations. This podcast is about one question: how to transform your team into peak performers. If you want the answer, keep listening. If you want it faster, visit salesreadinessgroup.com/podcast.
And we're going to start again with some of the research that we've just produced, and I think will be really interesting both to share and get some audience input on challenges that are affecting commercial productivity and some of the emerging approaches that we're seeing that help address that. So that's really the second topic, and talking about some really interesting talent research that's coming out. And the third piece is really, how do you enable that? So what's the roadmap to success, and what are some of the key components that we can think about and put into place to activate those new motions that we're going to talk about? But Nick, I'm going to turn it over to you and love to have you kind of kick things off and lead us through a little bit about, you know, what are the headwinds, what's going on in the industry, and then talk a little bit about the research that we've been doing.
Yeah, and this maybe is a little bit of just setting the stage for some of the research we did, but I think a lot of the the boxes here will speak to many of you in terms of what you're seeing across your businesses right now. Over on the left-hand side, you know, we kind of describe this lovingly as the world of more, and is the world that our customers currently live in as they engage in learning and buying behaviors in the marketplace. So they evaluate various solutions, various providers, for business services or business capabilities. And just to kind of work through these quickly, you know, these world of more implications are having an immense impact on customer buying behavior, which we're going to explore here in a little bit more detail. But just to rattle off a few things, and as I do this, Ray, what I really welcome from the audience is provide some inputs around what you're seeing your customers have to endure or go through, or what's changing in some of their buying behaviors. But let me just quick rifle through a few of these. So more information, not just are we dealing now with the synthesis of massive amounts of information through generative AI, but frankly, we've seen vendors really up their game in terms of producing more high quality thought leadership, more evidenced point of views, more research themselves, providing, you know, key inputs for business leaders on how they should be thinking about their business differently and how they should be thinking about solving problems in different ways they previously hadn't considered. So what we're seeing with more information is, well, it begets these learning journeys that turn into, I understand one point of view, now I see another point of view, yet I see another point of view, now I'm looking at AI, which has another point of view, and it creates more questions in many cases. And as we know, sort of more questions begets more research, begets more questions, and that cycle becomes difficult to break at some level. Now, the second thing we see going on that lower, that middle left there, is more options. So as we learn more about our business challenges and potential opportunities to solve those business challenges, we start to see more options that we now need to consider. So a breadth of requirements suddenly come into place. And as we're working with different suppliers or different vendors, we learn about new and kind capabilities they have, more flexible solutions that they might offer, more configuration that they could do to help us solve our problems as customers. And that just creates, again, more learning, more opportunity, more decisions that I have to go and make. And obviously, as more decisions and more opportunities enter the picture, that lower left becomes a reality. More people, more stakeholders, more points of view suddenly enter the commercial decision-making process here, where for me to make a decision and spend money, well, now I don't have to just turn one key to sort of open the box and move forward. I've got to turn three or four or five keys between legal or the CISO office who's concerned about customer data, privacy rights. I've got to suddenly bring into place IT. If I'm in a business, you know, line of business, and I'm purchasing something just for my line of business, well, it has data implications that, you know, our CIO is going to have to weigh in on and help us understand what does that mean for the business. I may have a variety of technical users and end users of that product who are going to have to wait. And so there's a variety of now different stakeholders who are part of the decision-making apparatus. And that's just on the customer side of things. And Ray, what I'll do is maybe draw everybody's attention over to the far right side of the slide. Because what we're seeing here is candidly, we as suppliers, we as vendors are doing more in terms of our own businesses to make things harder and tougher for customers to buy. Firstly, a lot of us have put in place, for good reason, a pretty significant focus on EBITDA and margin attainment over sort of growth. Now, what that means is we're asking our sales teams, our frontline teams, our customer success managers and account managers to just simply do more with less. And so they're resource constrained, they're feeling the stretch, and that results in a lesser customer experience, less time that we can spend with customers, less energy or attention we can put towards customers, because we're trying to work business frenetically and very productively to move it through the funnel. The second is we put in place, let's just face it, complex go-to-market structures. You know, 10 years ago, we weren't talking about ecosystems. We weren't talking about massive amounts of reliance on external partners in many cases. We weren't talking about this newfangled role of customer success managers, or there are very few companies maybe 10 years ago talking about it. So now we've got CSMs involved in customer accounts. We've got account managers involved. We've got specialists and overlays. We've still got account engineer or account executives. We've got sales engineers. We've got all kinds of roles involved in just the tapestry of working with a customer. In fact, if you go ask a customer, who's your sales rep? They're probably going to tell you the wrong role because they don't know. So we've added a lot of complexity into the go-to-market system. And the last thing I'd highlight, and this is going to be really relevant for this audience today, is there's just this hangover from the Great Resignation, where because we were putting anybody into the sales roles that had a pulse at that time, let's face it, we were all really hurting for talent. We ended up shifting our learning programs very dramatically towards onboarding and just get the people, all these new bodies in our business, get them remotely productive. We shifted longstanding development program dollars away from really bolstering and building our talent capabilities and moved it much more towards just quickly get people productive in seat. And our learning programs followed. We did a whole bunch of battlefield promotions for people who probably weren't ready for managerial roles at the helm of leading sales teams or customer success teams. And so there was a lot of just things we had to do. We were forced to do during that time period that now, 18 months later, we're dealing with the reality of all that. And so when you look in the center of the slide, it's no surprise. We're seeing significant amounts of risk aversion as customers think about spending money, move cautiously, move slowly. They buy at the lowest common denominator. They don't buy the big sort of aggressive purchase. They're very slow to make those decisions. And candidly, Ray, we see a lot of this nowadays, just purchase regret. We bought what we could kind of get over the finish line and get everybody to agree on. We didn't really buy the right thing, and now we're not going to retain with that product. We're not going to renew it. We're going to probably move on to something else. So I'll just pause here, because I'm curious, one, what the audience has to add to any of this, but two, you know, I'd love to hear from you guys. What are you seeing out there? What are we experiencing here collectively?
Yeah, I mean, what really resonates with me is, guess what? It really is harder. You know, it feels like deals take longer. It feels like there are more people involved. And, you know, you're going to share some of the research as well. That is actually the fact. Craig, I'm really curious. I saw you nodding in as Nick was going through that. You know, what resonated with you? And I'd ask the audience as well, you know, are one or two of these stronger, you know, headwinds that you're feeling? I put that into the chat. But if the audience wants to chat in, and Craig, love to hear from you, what resonates here? What are you seeing from your clients?
Yeah, I mean, I was nodding, you know, the more information, more options, that's certainly true. And we're seeing that coincide with a rise in buyer independence. They don't want to talk to sales. They are going to do as much research and tapping their own community and their own network as they can before they reach out and seek more information. And that raises the bar because you have fewer opportunities. But when you get those opportunities with your prospect and your front line, you got to nail them. And that's why today's topic, I think, is so important, is because those touch points with buyers are more important than ever. And they have a higher bar for engagement. If you're not relevant and you're not concise and you're not speaking to their specific challenges and needs, they're going to tune you out because there is too much other content that's fighting for their attention.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well said. Well, we'll give the audience, and again, if you have a comment or thought about what you're running into, love to hear it. But let's keep going here, Nick. And you know, I'm anxious for you to kind of walk through what we're hearing from CEOs and then what we saw across a very large sample of you know, sales teams as well.
Yeah. And so, you know, this is, it's funny. This is sort of We all feel this and know this, but it's good to kind of see it quantified here. So we do a lot of surveying of CEOs here at SBI, and we kind of keep the temperature quarter to quarter and just see how things are trending. And this was one of the biggest increases we saw kind of quarter on quarter in our CEO data in some time. But this was all around really seller productivity in different sort of dimensions of productivity from a sales vantage point. Look, the punchline of this page is very simple. CEOs are saying, we are feeling the productivity strain right now, whether you look at deal size, whether you look at deal velocity, or whether you look at seller productivity. But Ray, there's always sort of a silver lining in these kinds of doom and gloom slides, which is, there is a contingent here, kind of 30, 36%, 31%. Where things are in fact happening. And that was a little bit of the impetus as we embarked on our research study here, is trying to understand, okay, even when things are tough, there's always a group of people who kind of figure it out. And there's always a set of organizations who kind of figure it out. And I'm not saying, the organizations who have sort of the new and hot product, that the product just sells itself no matter what the market is. I'm saying they're doing the right things from a commercial engagement standpoint. Their go-to-market motion is just different, and they're beginning to break through in a pretty interesting way. And that was a bit of what we started to really shape the research around. And Ray, maybe we can get into some of just teeing up a little bit of how we did the research. We'll take folks through it real quick. And I certainly, again, welcome any questions, any input as we go through this.
Yeah. And, Mike made a comment, back on the previous slide, but said, the deal's done before getting involved in a lot of opportunities. So to the point of they have more access, they have that information, they've kind of made the decision and then they're validating, or they've already picked the vendor, but they're going through the motions. I mean, is that consistent with what you two are seeing?
Go ahead, Craig.
That's a little bit of a stretch, I think. I don't think the deals are done when our AEs get involved, but the research phase, I think we're seeing the SDRs getting cut out. In a complex B2B sale, though, there is still very much, I think, a need for sales and for custom attention and personalized education around the product and matching it to that customer's specific use cases. That I think can't really be done independently, but we are seeing more of the research happen prior to the face to face.
Well, I think it speaks to a really important point, Craig, which is we need to meet the seller or the buyer where they are. We need to figure out where they are in their buying journey. Sometimes they don't know, in which case we can probably help define and guide them. But oftentimes they're further along, and I think that was Mike's point, right? They're further along in that journey than we might like. But if we go back and try to do weeks worth of discovery on them, they're going to lose interest, or they're already moving forward. So we need to accelerate that, meet them where they are, and then get them the rest of the way, hopefully in alignment with where we're going. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, anticipating and helping to translate our solutions. So Nick, let's continue on and let's talk about the seller approaches. Yeah. And then specifically the manager approaches that are really helping to drive some of those productivity improvements. Can you talk a little bit about the research that we've been doing there?
Yeah. And Ray, maybe I'll preface all of this just to sort of bridge the comment from Mike in our last discussion, compared to where we're going with the research here. It's hard to believe. I think it was almost 15 years ago. We produced, when I was leading the sales practice at CEB, we produced a stat that showed that customers were 54% of the way through the purchase journey before they sort of picked up the phone and sort of, at the time, we actually said these words, picked up the phone and called the AE, because that was kind of how you did business 15 years ago. So it's hard to believe it was sort of that.
Classic stat, right?
This has been with us for a while, right? So it's hard to believe that stat. And I think there were a lot of subsequent stats that said it was further and further and further, along the purchase process. The point is, the ink still hadn't dried on deals. And I think, I always come back to sort of a truth, and we'll see this in this data, is that customers don't buy your services or your products every single day. Your teams do sell them. And helping the customer with that point of with sort of that knowledge base you have around how your solution is best purchased under this, what conditions is it best purchased? When's it going to be successful? When's it not? You know, we have a huge information advantage still on our side as suppliers, and that's going to sit at the center of a lot of what we see here. But let me just take you through the research. And I always love to put a slide in like this because it just helps you understand a little bit of the rigor that goes into the research that we produce. So this isn't sort of, one little survey and a few descriptive data points. This is a pretty rigorous process we went through. So at SBI, we have a standardized competency model. What's been great with SRG is we've now kind of combined these competency models and expanded kind of the standardized skills that we look at across different commercial roles. But you see over on the left-hand side, we took our sort of standard battery of commercial skills, commercial behaviors, and commercial competencies, and we ran a pretty significant survey to understand how are today's sellers sort of embracing and embarking on those kinds of behavioral skill sets, those particular methods with which they work with their customers and work with their colleagues internally. We took that survey data and basically we analyzed it across a variety of different industries and different considerations across the middle here. And what we produced at the far right-hand side is something we call a factor analysis, which is simply, it's a fancy way of saying that we did a statistical exercise to understand which types of behaviors and skills naturally co-present and sort of naturally clump together in terms of seller behaviors or what we're going to call approaches in terms of how they engage their customers in the marketplace. And we found four approaches through the course of doing that factor analysis. So, Ray, I mean, I'm not going to do a big drum roll here. Why don't we just go ahead and we'll skip to the next slide. I'll give you a sense of what we found, because this is more around discussing this versus sort of building up the research findings. But basically, we found four approaches that sellers today embrace. And I'll run through these with a little bit more detail. You probably get a sense based on some of their names. And here you see sort of the distribution on the slide of how those approaches present out there in nature. But over on the left-hand side, the most dominant or most common approach we found was something we call narrowing. And the approach for sellers who narrow was all about sort of closing the aperture quickly on the customer. And really, these individuals, like the currency they deal with and sort of work with their customers in, is one of urgency. I'm trying to create constant sort of urgency, nudge the customer forward. They tend to not bring in a bunch of internal subject matter experts. They tend to not involve their managers too much in their commercial pursuits because they don't want to create distraction. They don't want to create noise. They similarly sort of argue to their customers, let's not worry about bringing more stakeholders in. Let's try to keep this decision group fairly small in so much as the rep can kind of control those dynamics. But they make strong recommendations around, hey, let's just keep moving forward. Let's keep making progress. These are kind of the classic closers too, right? You see a lot of that sort of classic closing mindset associated with the narrowers. And I'll just say, given today's market dynamics and what we talked about a few slides ago, it is no surprise to see this particular profile as the most dominant profile. The second one is provoking. Now, some of you listening may or may not know, but I have a long lineage and history of doing all the Challenger sale work in my time leading the sales practice at CEB and co-authored one of the Challenger sale books. So provoking is sort of that Challenger sale type of approach to going out and instigating the customer. Really, we kind of say here the currency that these individuals who practice this provoking approach to work in is one of reconsideration. I'm constantly trying to get the customer to reconsider. So to Mike's comment earlier, if I've got a customer who's 80% of their way through the purchase process and they sort of show up at my front door and say, hey, here's the order I'd like to place, the natural response for these kinds of sellers is, well, hang on, you probably haven't considered everything. Let me make sure that you have. What we see with this provoking approach really in sort of a pretty prominent way, Ray, is lots of use of marketing content. As we said earlier, the content's gotten better. The points of view have gotten better. We're now providing evidence and doing research as part of our content marketing efforts. So you see a really tight relationship of these kinds of provoking sales approaches. And they have good proximity, good understanding of what's happening in the marketing channels of their organization and use that marketing content in a very forward way with their customers. The third one over is translating. This is a really interesting one, right? Because I think we often talk about sort of business acumen. We want to see our sellers use more business acumen and really try to express impact in financial terms to the customer. That's really what the translators do. They're very good about contextually putting impact into the customer's business context. So they don't just talk about the ROI and their solution. They talk about return on pain eliminated in the customer's organization. They take a lot of time to understand the economic levers in the customer's organization and then map the impact back to those economic levers. So there's a lot of thoughtfulness that goes into this kind of translating motion. And really, this is, I sort of think about this purchase, this sales approach being kind of denominated one of understanding. They want the customer to really understand what's happening in and around the implications to their business. And until the customer's understood what it means for the customer's business, they're not going to move forward. So translators are very good about translating that business value. And the last one is anticipate. And this one, it's similar to translating in that there's a lot of what I would almost consider customer empathy, customer understanding, customer context here. But anticipating is more around kind of greasing the skids and helping the customer really think through the decision dynamics, think about what they need to sort of determine next, how they should best think about that particular decision. They really help the customer frame up the decision. There's almost a Socratic kind of questioning approach that these individuals use with their customers, where I'm not going to tell you the answer and I'm not going to lead you to water. That would be narrowing. But what I am going to do is I'm going to frame how you maybe want to think about this, and I'm going to provide kind of guardrails for your decision-making process, and kind of I'll breadcrumb you through that particular decision. That's why we call it anticipating. You're one
step. These are some good breadcrumbs, Nick. I'm like dying to know, like, which of these work? Are like, they all sound pretty good.
You got a little bit of a drum roll here. So you know, we'll get into some of this in a minute, but hopefully you can start to think about, you know, individuals maybe you know in some of the sales channels, some of the sales reps, or even some of the people you've bought solutions from lately, and kind of start to bucket them in here. And one thing I will say, you guys, is look, the world isn't this simple. Not everybody fits into one of four. It's just like a DISC profile. What we see is kind of majors and minors. And we think there's actually a right optimal mix because, yeah, good anticipators also go close deals and they go into that narrowing mode once in a while. Sometimes someone's going to come in with an RFP that's totally wrong and we're going to have to provoke them and get them to reset some of the criteria so that it's more favorable to their business and more favorable to our solution. So, you know, there's a little bit of fungibility and a little bit of kind of, you got to use some of these in different mixes and different orders, but we will get to the punchline of the joke here in a second.
Yeah, well, then let's go there. And I want to make sure we have time to kind of dig into, well, how do we enable these approaches? And not saying one's good or bad, but it is interesting to think about which produce results and maybe where do we want to major, to your point, or where do we want to make sure we're supporting the skill development and supporting the skills with the team. And Craig, I'm already thinking about digital sales rooms and some of the things that Allego does, right? How do we use that to help empower and lead the customer to that decision? You know, some of the things like anticipating. But why don't you talk about that, Nick? What did you find? What came out when you looked at, you know, I'll just go back for a second. The primary or the largest group was narrowing, followed by translating, and then anticipating and provoking in terms of the percentages of the groups that we talked about. But in terms of their performance, it was a little different story, wasn't it?
A little different story. Yeah. So here we see narrowing and provoking, and we're going to start to kind of group these two together. And I think you'll see why in just a minute here, but narrowing and provoking both, extended sales cycle times. I mean, I can't say it any other way. We found that when individuals sort of practice this brand or this approach with their customers, they had longer sales cycle times on average. And as we get into a little bit of the rationale and understanding around why, you know, I'd ask the audience, think back to where we started with the changes in customer buying behavior, more info, more people, more options, you know, more team members that I'm facing off with from the vendors and suppliers I'm working with. You know, a lot of these dynamics play out here. And when you see narrowing and provoking, you know, these are very what I would say almost supplier outward or vendor outward type of behaviors. Like I am trying to move you onto a point of view that I, the vendor, have, and I hope you now have that point of view. And when you do that, given all those dynamics, it just creates a lot of friction, Ray. And not only a lot of friction with kind of your key stakeholder, but with those broader groups of stakeholders. And so we're finding that really pushing them through the sales process backfires in many cases. Now, conversely, Ray, if you want to go to the next slide, what we found is that the translating and anticipating approaches actually yield a shorter cycle time. And you may say, hey, well, Nick, I don't know, is 12% that much shorter? Well, I'd ask you, think a little bit about your typical cycle time. And if you've got, you know, if you've got kind of a 30-day sales cycle, or 100-day sales cycle and you look at 12% difference on that, think about the added number of opportunities you can get through the pipeline in a given year. Yeah, 12% is pretty economically powerful, particularly when you look at that 12% relative to 22% or 20% longer over on the left-hand side. That's a lift in sort of 30 points difference in terms of sales cycle time. So this is pretty material here. Now, the reason that those two, I want to be careful saying win, right? Because they don't necessarily win. There is a time and a place, again, for all these behaviors, all these approaches, but the sort of dominant arc of how these sales reps face off with customers, we see more productivity associated with two on the right, is because, again, going back to how customers buy, we are helping them manage that set of very real dynamics between competing interests, consensus that they're having to forge, dealing with all the options, dealing with all the learning. It is hard to buy things today. These types of sales motions help the customer slow down to process and understand the implications of the purchase, make the right purchase, right? Make the job of our CSMs later easier and make sure our retention numbers are high. But we end up doing the right thing by the customer and helping them make the right decision in the right sequence with the right set of implications considered here. And ultimately, you see a pretty significant uptick in terms of cycle time. Ray, go ahead and go one more forward. We also looked at a few other dynamics. So here's one, you know, a set of data points around deal size. And what you see here is, again, kind of a similar story, a little different. We do see narrowing provoking when done and done consistently with customers. Actually yields larger deal sizes. And that kind of makes sense because, again, we're helping the customer sort of get their heads wrapped around a given solution. Again, I still look at the trade-off in terms of cycle time and say, you know, I don't think that is the most productive approach out there, but it does yield, when done well, it can yield some larger deal sizes. But if you look at over on the right-hand side, translating, anticipating significantly larger deal sizes at a faster volume. Like, that is sort of the win-win box that we want to be in. So again, some benefit to narrowing, some benefit to provoking. We do think there's a time and a place. And I really think, Ray, more about those two approaches as more tactical approaches. I need to use those tools when I need to use them. But let's be careful sort of dominating the customer with a narrowing point of view or provoking point of view versus translating, anticipating. If I think about kind of the arc of the sales process, if I'm a seller, I really want to practice more that brand or blend of translating, anticipating versus narrowing, provoking, or sort of a little tool that I pull out once in a while when I need a tactical boost and need to kind of move the customer forward.
Yeah. And so I'm immediately thinking, well, how do we enable that then to be better at translating our solutions and first anticipating what the customer needs, where they're going, and provide the tools and the skills? And that's where we're really going to get to next. But just to wrap up the research, let's talk about kind of how the sellers broke out. And then I really want to tee up the conversation about the managers, because again, the poor frontline manager is kind of left holding the bag here saying, well, wait, what do I do? And what did you see in terms of how they were managing the team and how they were looking at those approaches?
Yeah. So left-hand side, we already saw this data. That was the distribution of those four approaches across the sales population. We also isolated the sales management population on the right-hand side, found that not only is narrowing, you know, more pronounced, but it's significantly more pronounced, which isn't surprising. Provoking, a little bit more pronounced, but that narrowing one is the one we saw most sort of dominant or most common among the managers. And Ray, this sort of only stands to reason that when times are tough and we're in a bit of a sideways economic environment, I think we can all agree to that. When times are tough, managers really begin to feel the crunch. And the belief is, I need to practice this sort of brand of narrowing. I need to push or compel business through the funnel quickly. And I'm going to take that mindset into my teams. Close, 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 move it forward, move it forward, move it forward, as opposed to, you know, hey, let's slow down. Let's work a more limited number of opportunities more thoughtfully. Let's really plan around them carefully. Let's treat them as very precious and prioritized opportunities. Let's put the right resourcing against them and let's go win those pieces of business. And so what you see is sort of a, you know, you default almost to the volume metric, sort of run everything you can through the funnel and just drive, 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 because dang it, we need to close some business, as opposed to, hang on, let's slow down to speed up. Let's be thoughtful. Let's be planful. Let's follow the playbook. Let's follow the enablement. Let's do the right things to help this customer make a decision and ultimately speed up and boost deal size as a result.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just think, you know, it's an organizational issue too, where if from the top down, they're looking for the numbers, they want to see the forecast, they want to see what's going to close, yep. That trickles down to the manager and then trickles down to the sales team. And I think in our experience, we've found with deal coaching, most managers are pretty good at deal coaching because that's what they grew up doing, is closing deals. They're not as good at managing and coaching skills and managing performance, like taking a longer term view. And as you said, slowing down to speed up and saying, well, what behaviors do we need to see to support this? So let's just capture one other thought. And I'd love to get your input on this, Craig. You know, the idea of a wedge versus a nail. And I love your analogy, Nick. Maybe you could walk us through this and then get.
Yeah, super high level. Because I'm curious, Craig, you know, what do you guys see in particular as you get into helping enable a more thoughtful, planful sales approach? I think that's really what this slide speaks to. But over on the left, I think what you generally find is that the sellers who practice that brand or that type of narrowing versus or provoking approach, their funnels tend to look more like a wedge. And what do I mean by that? Well, really, this is about working a large number of opportunities, sort of a volumetrics-driven sales approach. I aggressively qualify a lot of business in. Everything sounds good from the beginning. And customers just sort of opt out on their own over time. I end up putting minimal amounts of energy or effort into any one opportunity because I tend to be working so many opportunities. And there's just a significant amount of frenetic activity, but I'm not really putting the quality into any given opportunity. Conversely, the translating and anticipating approaches, these require planning. They require thoughtfulness. They require preparation going into the sales conversation. They require a lot of collaboration internally to make sure I've thought through and prepared for what I'm going to encounter, and I can help steer the customer out of that side spin. And so what you see here is just the funnel. It looks different for these kinds of sellers. They aggressively disqualify business out. They stick to the ICP. They stress opportunity and account fit. They use the tools, the account plans, the enablement, the resources provided to them to thoughtfully and really planfully work the opportunities in front of them. So sort of the amount of energy that goes in any one opportunity, far greater on the right-hand side than on the left-hand side. But Craig, I'd really be curious from Allego's point of view, as you see kind of usage and application of enablement to support this, what are you guys seeing?
Yeah. So I'm digesting this research with a lot of other folks here on the call. And this is fascinating. In some ways, it makes sense if we think about buyers becoming more independent. Perhaps in the past, there was a greater education gap and sales had a greater responsibility to educate and inform and shift the thinking. But I think with this rise in buyer independence and the access to information and communities and you know, their ability to get in touch with other customers that are maybe already using the solution, is they're coming in more informed and they don't want to be moved.
Yep.
And that's why I think those translating and anticipating approaches are working. So then from an enablement perspective, my mind thinks, well, what does that look like at an individual company? And I imagine that it's going to be different depending on what you're selling and what industry you're in. But understanding what does a good translating call or meeting look like? What does a good anticipating call or meeting look like? In our research of conversation intelligence data, we know that our top performers have more conversation switches. They ask more questions, they speak slower, and the calls last longer. And I think that all fits with what you're saying here. And it does require more preparation because the less prepared you are, you actually talk more. Yep. And you find yourself over-talking because you're anxious. Whereas when you're prepared, your ability to listen actively and anticipate that prospect's needs increase the more prepared you are. You become a better listener and you're able to be more relevant and add more value. So in a lot of ways, this is really clicking for me personally.
Yeah. And Craig, you know, a point I'd just add to that, this came out of the research, and For those who are interested, we have kind of the white paper on the SBI site here, which goes a lot deeper into these particular approaches. But one of the things you'll see as a common theme across translating and anticipating is the use of the resources internally. They look, this isn't rocket science. They use the planning, the account planning forms. They use the territory planning approaches. They use the opportunity planning tools. They also have a much higher collaborative sort of DNA where they talk to their peers and say, hey, here's what I'm up against. Here's kind of what I'm dealing with. Here's what my hypothesis is and what this opportunity is going to say and what I think they're going to object to. Like, help me think through what I need to do in advance. So I go in and maybe it wasn't exactly that objection, but man, I'm much better prepared to handle what I'm about to hear. To your point, Craig, I think that collaborative piece of this too is really, really important versus over on the left, there's a lot more like, I'm not going to bother with anybody internally. I'm not going to do that much preparation because I can't apply that much thought to anyone because I am just running a volume-based pipe. Go, 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 go. It's really interesting.
Right. Well, hey, Nick, I just put the link to, you can download it off the SBI website. We'll also have a follow-up that'll include the recording and follow-up information. And we have a link to the digital sales room. So just want to make sure if people want more information or want to dig into this in more detail, we can do that. But I do think it's interesting, Craig, when we think about how do we enable the seller and then how do we enable the manager, right, to be more effective? And what are some of those things that we can do? So I want to be sensitive to our time. And Nick, I know you need to drop a little bit early. And we'll allow some time for questions. But in terms of, you know, three components that we can help to drive that improved productivity, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about, well, how do we help the managers coach? Because again, we want them to support those behaviors that are going to be most effective, right? So those that are going to drive shorter cycle time and larger deals, we'd like more of those, more of that. And if that's anticipating and translating, what does that look like? What are the enablement tools and environment we can put in place? And then how do we realign expectations around that? So maybe we could go through these fairly quickly. Wanted to talk about, and we do a lot of work around both sales coaching playbooks within SBI and the sales coaching training, right? To take this and codify it or package it in a way that gives the manager access to those resources. So they know how to coach the deals. They know what skills they're looking for and behaviors that align within your own sales process, but to align to those approaches that are going to be most effective, the cadence and process that you're going to go through, and then how we actually put that into practice. And, you know, what we know from our own SRG research is, you know, close to 3/4 of managers say they don't get the training they need, though those organizations that invest in training their managers, no surprise to this audience, are more effective, right? So they end up producing and performing at a higher level. Craig, maybe we could get your thoughts on this as well. You know, how do you look at enabling that frontline manager and what things come to mind when you're thinking about, you know, providing that ecosystem and helping them be better coaches and managers?
There's a reason everybody is talking about this right now, because during the 10-year bull market, a lot of managers got, you know, kudos and raises and promotions because the economy was great, but they weren't actually managing their team well. A lot of that business was flowing in almost despite them. And now with these economic headwinds, a lot of managers are being exposed. They never got the training. They've never been enabled. And when you enable your frontline sales managers, there's a multiplier effect, right? If you're in enablement, you're a sales leader, and you try to, you know, force messaging to the sellers directly, that's going to be very, very inefficient. But if you're able to enable the enabler, right, you get that multiplier effect, because everything that your sales team is trying to do, your whole go-to-market motion, it goes through your frontline sales managers. And they are responsible for the change management, the reinforcement, the accountability, the measurement, the reporting, right? So if you're not enabling them and giving them the confidence to actually impact the sellers, you're not going to have sustainable change. You might be able to change behaviors for a week or two after a training, but it's not going to sustain itself without enabling those frontline sales managers. So we're seeing a huge focus from our customers now on enabling the frontline sales managers, having structured programs designed for them so that they can gain those management skills the ability to coach each person as an individual, you know, not putting people into one box with one size fits all, being very mindful about these checking the box type of certifications, because those can be very unpersonalized and not very helpful for every seller when it's just you have a checklist of things that you want to hit in a discovery call. That's not really the best approach because it doesn't take into account that specific context and where that prospect is, right? So context is key, and personalizing the coaching for each seller and meeting them where they are, that stuff needs to be trained. I mean, I think very few people are naturally great managers. So there's a lot of education that's required, I think, and a lot of opportunity in enabling those frontline sales managers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think your point about you're not going to be able to just program this, right, or automate all of it and say, oh, well, it just spits out the answer. I still think the best coaching is one-on-one. It's collaborative. It takes a coaching mindset. The beauty is we now have tools and technology that we can use that provides a lot more insight and helps the manager do that job. But it's not a matter of just turning on the widget, right, and having it do it for us. But I'd love to get your thoughts and then Nick's as well on, you know, when we think about some of those enablement tools, how does this come into play? You touched on a few of these here.
Yeah, I mean, sellers need to practice, right? So the practice tools are just getting so great, right? With generative AI, at Allego, we have a tool called Dialogue Simulator. It's like you're talking to a real prospect, but you're practicing. And you're getting real-time feedback. So that's really one of the best ways. And then the other best reinforcement tool or learning tool that really drives behavior change is learning from your top performing peers. So if you're a frontline sales manager, you want to be creating that team, tiger team of those top performers that everybody on the team that they respect. And they're going to listen to. And if people can learn from best practice examples, like, hey, here's a great example of how Melissa, top performer last year, you know, anticipated the customer needs on this call. And, you know, check out minute, you know, six, right, for the best snippet from this. And you share that across the team. That is going to drive more impact than you trying to kind of hammer them over the head in a group setting, right? Let them learn from their peers that they respect and trust that are out there grinding just like them. And that's who they want to model after and copy behaviors from. And then the conversation intelligence tools now are just so phenomenal and take the burden off of the frontline sales manager and the coaches, because we all know there's never enough time to coach. It's everyone's top priority until it gets knocked off the priority list, right? So making our sellers as self-sufficient as possible, because if they can watch their own game tape, I'll tell you, no one's a better coach than themselves. Of course, you're going to have your blind spots. So that's why you definitely need one-on-one coaching. But making your sellers self-sufficient so that they can watch their own game tape, they're going to be their own best coach, because they're going to see every flaw and everything that they did wrong. Because that's what we do as humans, right? We always look for the negatives. It's like painful to watch ourselves. But when you can get people to do that, their game is going to improve so much by forcing that self-reflection and evaluation. And that takes the burden off of coaches, which is great.
Well, Nick, I know you've looked at a lot of revenue operations and revenue enablement tools and in the practice. I'd love to have you share any final thoughts. And I know you have another session you need to jump to, but you know, how would you pull this together for us?
Yeah, no, and you know, look, my thought is, and I kind of go back to understanding how your teams are using the most precious thing they have, which is their time. I think to Craig's point, like, you know, look, the infrastructure here to support successful sales motions has never been better, right? Just tremendous amount of options. I think we continue to take what is, you know, extremely good enablement resources, learning opportunities, application opportunities, planning, guidance, tools, intelligence. There's so much that's available to the sellers. And you ultimately start asking teams, frontline teams, well, how much do you use this? Like, well, I don't have time to use it. And I kind of go back to that nail wedge point. And I, you know, we've looked at, we do a lot of time studies here at SBI, and we try to understand how are successful individuals spending their time, and you will see it. And by the way, I mean, I've done 20 years of time studies with sales teams. And like, there is a irrefutable truth that the successful reps don't spend more time in the field with their customers. They spend more time preparing and planning. They work fewer opportunities and they leverage these kinds of resources. So, you know, Ray, I look at it less, there is tremendous amounts of technology, and I'd love to have a call just on that, you know, in terms of workflow embedded type of advice and very dynamic type of advice. And even I still, what I grabbed over here off my bookshelf is like the old school playbooks. Like, these things still work. They're great if you have the energy and the patience and the time to put into applying this to an opportunity. Like, I'm sick of hearing the excuse, well, I don't have time to do it, or it doesn't fit neatly enough into my workflow because I'm too busy. It means you're working too many bad pieces of business and you're not planning and you're not going to execute successfully. So enablement, awesome, but you got to apply it.
No, I think it's great. And I think if this allows us to be more effective and efficient, that's a key aspect, which is, and we see it all the time, right? Managers are there trying to close deals. They're trying to join every call. They're trying to do the negotiation, be the Uber rep, and they're never going to scale that way. So they need to focus in the time and they need to help their reps focus in the opportunities. And I think that comes through better coaching, right? And better visibility into what's working and what isn't. And like you said, Craig, you know, playing back the game tape and focusing in on those things that are going to make a difference, not giving them a scorecard with 10 things they need to fix, because they're never going to be able to balance that and pull that together. So, well, let's just wrap with this third area. So we said coaching was important, enablement was important, and then resetting expectations and creating that operating environment. And so, you know, I think it's critical. One, we may need to reset the expectations, you know, set those communications around what are we looking for? What are the results? What are the behaviors that are going to get us the results? What are we really measuring? You know, kind of like a SMART goal over what period of time? So if we're thinking about these are the outcomes we're looking for, let's reset on the fact that we want to enable these behaviors and it's a longer term maybe view. We need to do the research. We need to do the planning. We need to prepare, as you were talking about, Craig, and then we need to help those managers, you know, to better coach and better support and reinforce their teams. I guess, what would you add to this? You know, we kind of need to rethink maybe that frontline manager role, or at least what we're forcing them to do. It's not just close business by the end of the month, because we know that provoking or a narrowing view isn't proving to be the most successful. But what else would you add to this?
Yeah, you know, when I think of the challenges that managers are facing, it's similar to the challenges sellers are facing with that lack of time, you know. So making the managers efficient and making sure that they can, hey, if they have 2 hours a week to do one-on-one coaching, or if they only have an hour to do group coaching, how do we make the most of that time? And that requires that they have a good understanding of the team-wide behaviors, so that when they choose what they want to focus their limited time on, it's having the maximum impact. So understanding the team-wide behaviors becomes important. And that's always been really hard without listening to a ton of data or calls. But now the modern tools are doing that for the managers and identifying, hey, these are your team-wide challenges, or these are the areas that the most sellers are struggling with. And that allows you to focus that team coaching time on areas that are going to help the most sellers, which I think is a really nice kind of a cheat code for coaching and making them more efficient.
Yeah. Well, I think it starts with, you know, what does good look like? And then leveraging tools like a Lego to say, well, what's actually working? And let's start looking at the results and the behaviors, you know, the calls, the recordings, et cetera. So I think it's an exciting time as this all starts to come together. Look, I know we've covered a lot of ground here. You know, I wanted to, one, give a few minutes if people do have questions or want to follow up specifically. And also, you know, maybe I can turn it over to Marcus here briefly, and you can just talk about that. You will be getting a follow-up as well as if you want to talk about the digital sales room and kind of how you teed that up, I think it's a nice use of, you know, some of the follow-up information.
Yeah, thanks, Ray. I actually am just going to add in the link there, but you can pull out your phone and snap the picture of the QR code. It'll go straight to this digital room. Within it, you'll see a bunch of free resources, some of our past webinars with Sales Readiness Group, and the recording will be located within this digital sales room as soon as it's done, as soon as we're done here. And I'm also going to add in that white paper that Nick was talking about as well. So check that out. We'll send it out the links within the recording as well. So take a look.
That's great. Well, and again, Craig, thank you very much for joining us today. It's always good to riff on these topics, especially, you know, some new emerging areas and some things hopefully for our audience to think about. Nick had to drop for another presentation, busy time of year for him and with the research coming out, but appreciate, you know, the conversation. If people do want more information, you know, feel free to reach out. And again, we'll have the follow-up information. Any closing thoughts for our audience today, Craig?
Did we get any questions, Marcus, from the audience?
Let me check here. We actually answered them all as we went.
Yeah, I mean, I think just the closing thoughts that I have, I think, come down to culture. And I think culture can be such a difference maker, right? We focus so much on tactics and, you know, hey, what are the things we're going to go implement? But a lot of it does start with culture. And you can try to do all the right tactics. If you don't have the culture, it's not really going to work. And when I think about healthy sales cultures, I think about vulnerability. Because the more vulnerable your sellers are, the more likely they are to share mistakes that they might make. Offer learning to other sellers so they don't have to make those mistakes. Anytime that somebody learns something, it's usually they learned it because they screwed something up and they learned. And it's important to share those things. And it's also really hard. So one of the things I know that we do at Allego is we incentivize people sharing their mistakes. One of our operating principles is to embrace mistakes and celebrate them. And I think that if you have that type of a culture and can build that type of a culture, the knowledge sharing and the level that you can ramp up sellers, it can really, really accelerate because your sellers are learning from each other. And that can make such a huge difference here.
The market is changing, making sales skills more important than ever before. How to transform your team into peak performers? If you want the answer, plus free resources for podcast listeners, visit salesreadinessgroup.com/podcast.